A very good evening. Andre has asked if I would speak a little bit on basic Buddhism. And I don't know much about what it might be, but to begin from somewhere, I think what is essential to understand in today's times about Buddhism, I think, is the essence of Buddha Dharma or the Buddhist teachings. Emphasize kindness. But before getting to that part, I'd like to come back a little bit to all of us come from different diverse backgrounds. I come from India. I was born in India. But tracing my family back, we still would refer to ourselves as Tibetans. And so walking into Walmart the other day in Luray, people waved to us and called us, oh, the people are from the Dalai Lama's group. And so many of you are familiar with that name, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, our teacher, our guide, and our spiritual master. And we try to follow his example, really try and cultivate the teachings of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, many of our teachers, some whom you may be familiar with because you have family members who are practicing, and many, many teachers, but primarily the teacher that we do recognize as the genuine teacher or the first teacher is referred to or named as Shakyamuni Buddha, or the Enlightened One, or the Buddha, as we call him. So the historical beginning of Buddha Dharma we find in India some 2,500 years ago. It is said that Siddhartha, as his name was, sat in meditation and tried to go deep into understanding who we are as human beings and what are our inner potentials that need to be cultivated. Beginning from that, Buddhism, historically, the Buddhist teachings began in that perspective. But I think if today and from the perspective of Buddhism and its origination and flourish today, what would also be correct to say is Buddha didn't intend to find a separate philosophy that would be in any way contradictory of any other philosophy or belief. So coming from the East, someone who studies meditation and tries to understand what the Buddha taught, what we find at a point is the recognition or the understanding that what it means to be a Buddhist means to not be anything particularly, but to be able to ground first the understanding of human potential and develop that potential in accordance to what is expected out of a living being who can think, who can discern, who can understand, who can actually have a mind that can do the things that it should do and not do the things that it should not do. So from that perspective, today, because it's a common approach, and particularly in today's times where religion has become, I think, more practiced or more known than ever before, I think every civilization has had many different philosophies and teachings and faith or devotional aspects and philosophies, doctrines have originated, each of them very precious, whether it is Christianity, whether it is Islam, whether it is Hinduism or Judaism or whatever it may be. I think at that period of time, that civilization has gained much more from that particular philosophy, whichever arose in that civilization, than would have if another philosophy would have come into that civilization. So you see, growth of Islam, we find that what Islam did for that particular region, I think was remarkable. And probably Buddhism or Hinduism or Christianity couldn't have done that at that time to those number of people who understood that language, who understood that view. Likewise, Christianity and the immense growth of Christianity and the benefit and the genuine goodness that it brought to the Western civilization, as well as now in last years in the Eastern civilization, has done so much goodness that possibly Islam or Buddhism or any other philosophy in that time, in that region, couldn't have brought about. It simply is that the goodness of an enlightened person, and the term enlightened person would be a person who's a genuine thinker, and at the core of one's own heart would have the wish to helping others without expectation, without any selfishness, but a genuine wish to be of kindness to the others. Such an enlightened person comes up with, how best can I help someone? How best can I help people? Whether it is in conflict, whether it is in being able to understand human tendencies, whether it is in bringing happiness, whether it is in bringing more awareness, more sanity. And so, whether it is Jesus Christ, whether it is Buddha himself, whether it is Muhammad, whether it is Shiva or Vishnu or whoever it may be, comes up at a certain time, what we Buddhists say, through the blessings and the aspiration and listening to the hopes of the people, brings up forth a philosophy and a view that at that point of civilization, at that point, could enable a person to think more. A human being behaving as a human being. That is, I think, the basis of all the fundamental basis of all the philosophies. And we as a human society of human beings have survived. And the goodness has survived. And sanity has survived. And wisdom has survived. And civilizations have survived because of having founded on the principles of these various philosophies and teachings. On the other hand, today we find also as much growth that has happened. And today probably, I've always thought that 40s, the end of World War II, there came a time when the world went through such a change that up till our parents' generation, it almost seemed as people began to have a much more critical perspective of anything to do with spirituality and some kind of skepticism and critical eye on philosophy was there. That has probably changed in the 80s, 90s, and then the turn of the century. What we find is some kind of a revival. Part reason of the revival of the interest of spirituality, where we all are taking a keen interest in spiritual belief, whether in our own culture and in our own countries, or whether in exploring other country, other philosophies, or philosophies belonging to other civilizations. But there's a general interest, there's a genuine growth. 20 years ago, the common approach just to Buddhism was very different than what we see today. Part reason, as I was saying, is it is a fashionable thing to do. I've always thought it was because of the immense speediness with which mass media works and printing of books. And you go to any bookstore, you find these days an abundance of books on spirituality of every different kinds that are there, not only the major world religions, but all subgroups and subdivisions. And there's so much wealth and material available on spirituality. That is one reason. The other reason is also people, very famous people, whether it's Oprah Winfrey or whether it is Jerry Springer or whether whoever it may be, talks about religion and philosophy. And that makes the larger population aware that there's something going on that we need to know. So people pick up words such as compassion. And in Walmart, you hear people talking about the Dalai Lama, or you hear about meditation or contemplation. And words just become, by word of mouth, people begin to become more aware of spirituality. So that's good. As much as it is good, it has a downside. The downside is, I think, what we all experience, and that is immense suspicion and immense hesitation, immense fear when it comes to just this immense growth that is taking place. When there's a very speedy growth of interest in spirituality, probably what happens is many of the genuinely concerned people would then have some sense of a chaos developing. Too many things mixing up, too many things coming in, new information coming in, and not really feeling ready to understand what it is that is fast developing. And sometimes, as a Buddhist, I personally experience that also, the growth of Buddhism. As we see, we travel the year round, we give a lot of talks and teachings and present the idea of what Buddhism is. But often, if you sit down and think carefully, you do develop some sense of, it's almost like grass growing everywhere. And you don't really, can't speed up the lawnmower as fast as the growth of the grass is happening. And so with that sense, there's some sense of uncomfortableness or hesitation that has happened. The other hand is where even in spirituality, there is politics. Even in spirituality, there is profit and loss. Even in spirituality, while it should not breed any kind of dishonesty, there is dishonesty, dishonest to your own approach of your own philosophy. All that leads to a world that is skeptic about one another. And so at such a time, what we think is the immense necessity for everyone who is spiritually inclined, doesn't have to be a very focused meditator or a practitioner or a philosopher, but anyone who has awareness of the need of the time, of human responsibilities, to have, I think, a proper understanding of the many different things that are developing. And so from that perspective, I would say, if anyone were to ask me, what is Buddhism? And people often do. I've always joked that when we move around with this uniform of a nun with shaved heads, people who walk up to you, the first question they'll always say is, in 5 minutes, explain what is Buddhism, or in a very short period of time. Now, if we have over the course of 10, 15 years, we can probably gradually talk about what Buddhist philosophy is. But within 5 minutes, if someone were to ask me to say what Buddhism is, and in these last 15 years of being in the West, I haven't come up with one short, quick answer. It's very difficult. But as much as, and oftentimes when we meet that situation, that has led to today, if somebody was supposed to ask me that question, I would say, actually what Buddhism means, and truthfully speaking, what Buddhism means is to be true to whatever you are. Because the term Buddhism actually means nothing. Nothing something. It's very difficult. It's very something. Because if you see, when Buddha attained, 2,500 years ago or so, when Buddha attained that understanding, what did he attain was not another philosophy, but what he obtained as his understanding was how to be a good human being. His intention in the texts and the teachings of Buddha Dharma, we will find, was about a refining way of saying, as an individual person, I can think, I can speak, I can actually function with my body and my senses, and there's a responsibility. If there is a frog, that's a very Tibetan, old Tibetan habit of taking very what would be called simple metaphors, but it still serves its purposes. So if I take a frog and if I take myself, okay, all right. So there's some difference. Out of deep respect for the frog, I like frogs and they're nice and they're very pretty, but there's some difference between a frog and myself. The difference being is that I do have discriminating capabilities that are a little bit more refined than a frog. So whom would you expect to be a better being, a frog or a human being? Say a human being. A human being. Yes, a human being. All right. So in that same principle, it's a simple practice, it's a simple example, but it's the same thing. As a human being, when one is endowed with the quality of thinking and discerning and discriminating, it is necessary that we do exercise that potential, that intelligence, that awareness, and that mindfulness. And so from that perspective, His Holiness the Dalai Lama always in his teachings talk about how you can be a good Christian Buddhist, Hindu Buddhist, Buddhist Buddhist, Muslim Buddhist, or whatever religion you use, and then you cultivate the Buddhist principle. And so Buddhism, in its core practice, from a very spiritual, if we don't see the abstractness of what Buddhism means, but if you see a very traditional approach to Buddhism, process of its meditation is also to train a meditator, one who's practicing Buddhism, to allow the disintegration of different forms that we make and which we think are important, but which end up usually as being excuses to not using our own mind properly. To think, to discern, to be able to choose between what is right and wrong, and most importantly, what we call enlightenment, which simply is knowing the truth. Neither my truth nor your truth, neither the truth of this religion or that philosophy, but truth as it naturally and truly is. And that emphasizes the path of practice of meditation is how can we actually walk on the ground that would enable us to sharpen our own human intelligence, to be able to really see what it is that a human being needs to do, what it is that we can do. If we have a mind that can think, what should it be thinking about? If we have the capacity to speak, what is it that it should actually be using its speech for? If we have a body that is there that can function and all the senses that it can actually see and hear, there would be more than just flowing with the flow, as you say, but a way of being able to sit and say, maybe I can do a little bit better than the croaking of a frog is say something sensible, say something that is worthwhile, say something that is kind, say something that is good, and if not, at least refrain from usage of speech that is harmful to the others. If I can do something physically because my body is capable, maybe I can construct something good. Maybe I can give something that is generous. Maybe I can help someone with service. But if it can't, perhaps I should also reflect back at the other easier potential, and that is refrain from using my body in a harmful way. And most importantly, seeing that there's a mind and an intelligence, a discerning mind that is behind. And it can think of many different things. It can conjure, it can imagine, it can be able to ponder and contemplate and reflect upon. Being able to then see if that mind can be used in a much more positive way by giving awareness, by being able to be kind, by generating positive thoughts of generosity, of patience, mind that is pretty much intrinsic of one's own self. And if it is something that I have, that is intrinsic of myself, I should have also the power to take it the way I want it to be. After all, I am a human being. So if a rider is a skillful rider, we say usually that rider is able to take the horse or steer the horse in a direction that the rider wants to go. If the rider happens to be someone like myself who's never ridden a horse properly, basically the horse will take the rider wherever it wants to go, isn't it? So likewise, you have a mind. Most oftentimes, if we look carefully, mind is intrinsic of a human being, and so a human being should be able to dictate where it wants its mind to go or what it wants its mind to think about. But like a unskilled rider, often mind is in one direction, body seems to be in another direction. And then, again, from the Buddhist perspective, it would be okay if it was just the horse and the rider. But then, say happen that the actions that we do and the different thoughts that the mind generate actually impacts others. And so Buddhism talks about interdependency. Realize that all this responsibility of being a human and developing human awareness is important, not only because you are someone who is better than a frog, but because frog affects less than you're affecting the others. You have a family, you have a community, you take things from the people, you're dependent on the others are dependent upon you. And therefore, where you understand the dependency, shouldn't that same human being with that level of discriminating wisdom or awareness or intelligence be a little bit more aware of social responsibilities? And so out of that growth of, oh yes, I am interdependency, I depend on the others depend upon me, that then progresses into what the Buddha taught as awareness of suffering. Not the bleakness of the suffering, but just the immense unhappiness or suffering that you could cause because of yourself not being a skillful rider of your own mind. And so we find that it's not only about interdependency, but it's a lot more about within that interdependency, how much and how easily we create action that affects our happiness and that affects our sadness. So in that way, in contemplation and meditation, sometimes we sit down and we think about and we come to a point where we say, it's so easy to actually be a good person, but we don't do that. And that's the suffering aspect. If someone again asks, simplify what the Buddha meant by the essence of the world being suffering, then another way to look at it is, there is no reason why this group of people, now let's say, let's not talk about the others, but since we're here, this group, there's no reason why this group of people actually couldn't be the best of the people. Kindest, generous, never selfish, never arrogant, never competitive, never confused. But at the same time, while that is a potential, and we could all agree that from this moment, none of us need to go into the wrong direction of cultivating negative actions, but still we are unable to do it. And so we find a sense of uncontrolled state, not being able to do what we want to do. That, in the Buddhist perspective, is often talked about as suffering that arises from ignorance. A very simple cause of not knowing, therefore called ignorance, but that which leads to missing out on the understanding of interdependency, missing out on the understanding of how we affect each other's life, and then because of that not knowing, the carelessness and the unawareness, we end up bringing about immense problems and difficulties in each other's life as well as into our own lives. And so if we take from that perspective, anger, it's not necessary. We teach our children, even as a person who has absolutely no belief in any spirituality, will say the same things the Buddhist talks about. Anger is bad, abandon anger. We teach our children to give up jealousy, not to be jealous, not to be angry, not to be hurtful to one another, to be patient, to be generous, to be kind. And despite that same instruction that we give to our own children or to the younger people or to one another, we forget that when we look at our own actions. And so we find that human wisdom or human intelligence very easily lets us understand interdependency and how we affect each other's life. We also find our human body, human speech, human mind, something that is intrinsic and can be actually trained, and yet we don't do that. And not doing that, we end up creating many actions each day, actions that were never intended to harm somebody else, but there's a certain uncontrolled state, a habit that is formed, where very easily we harm one another. Without intending to, we become selfish. Without intending to, we hurt each other. Without intending to, we simply sink into carelessness of our attitude and intention. And out of that carelessness comes about the unfeelingness. And so a human mind that can feel generosity and kindness as important qualities, yet forgets that very easily, and a lot of negative actions come out. And so Buddha, in his understanding and analysis, began to look at that human pattern of the goodness and the potential, the capability of being the rider of one's own mind and being able to tame it and train it. Buddha said simply, you have a speech, the ability to talk, you have a mind, the ability to think, you have the body and the ability for it to perform actions. The simple question would be, is would it not be better if it was in a little bit more controlled state where you could have your body do the things that are helpful, since you are interdependent with the others? If you have a speech, would it not be better if one exercised a little bit of mindfulness so that what arose as speech could be good, refraining from doing something that is harmful? And likewise, it is your mind. Thoughts that are generated is a process of your own mind's ability to think. Therefore, as a skillful writer, would it not be better if the thoughts that you generated were constructive and at least not destructive? And so the basic first instruction of the Buddha was, be a good human being. Simple, very simple. I've always thought very simple, but simple thing is something we don't like. And particularly when it becomes people who are spiritually inclined, we refuse to believe that anything that has to be profound couldn't be simple. And that's the same bad habit too. You ask the ones who've been Buddhists for 20, 30 years, there's still a fascination for the most complicated theory. And you tend to think that your ego and your individuality needs to be sustained on complexities. And simplicity is something that is lost. So it got lost during the time of Buddha himself. It's not only this generation that lost it and made it complicated, but the first five disciples who received the teachings and understood what the Buddha was saying, it is said historically, refused to take the simplicity of his teachings and asked him simply, "Wise, why do I need to be good? Why do I need to believe in you? Why do I need to do the things that you want me to do?" And so when the question why is asked, I've always said you'll get an answer. If you put a question, you get an answer. And so if to that answer, if you're not satisfied and you ask further question, it becomes a system. It becomes a discipline. Buddha did not, as most teachers, do not want to create a path, a dictum, a philosophy, a religion. And therefore, Buddhism began not so long ago, 2,000 years ago, as that philosophy that emphasized completely a view and not a dictum, not a philosophy. Buddhism disagrees with the fact that it is categorized as a religion. In our tradition in the East, for example, if you say I'm a Buddhist, it does not mean you are particularly inclined towards a particular religion. It is a thought, it is a view that has to be cultivated in the mind of a human being. That is what we emphasize. But then again, complexity is sometimes very tempting, and complexities allow our ego to think that it is doing something very worthwhile. And so for a stubborn mind, then again, the kindness of the Buddha is in that in the subsequent teachings, he explained it, and he explained it as a philosophy, as a path, as a religion, as a spiritual belief, so that quite similar to the old example that I always use. If there's a stubborn donkey that doesn't move, sometimes it helps to put a carrot in front of the donkey to make it move a little bit. Likewise, I think Buddhism also, for a stubborn mind that simply will not take the simplicity of the instructions of being a good person and will think that becoming a good human being is an easy thing to do, will be given a bunch of carrots that say, sit on a square cushion for 7 years and meditate before you figure out that you have to be a good person. So that led to a system. That led to a tradition. That led to 1,200 years of what we call Tibetan Buddhism that has many different kinds of things, such as the shrine that you see. We have statues, although the first instruction of the Buddha was never make a statue because truth doesn't have a statue. It can't be formulated as a statue. But we thought, no, even that has to be done. And as soon as the Buddha died, we made a statue of him. And so that is, again, if now somebody says, oh, as a Buddhist, why do you prostrate to a statue? Then we have a long explanation about actually we are not prostrating to a statue, but we are prostrating to the essence of the statue. But still, until there's a mind that says East is East and the statue has to be placed there and I need to prostrate to it. And if that inspires you to be a good person, we think, let that person be. And until he or she figures out that you don't need a statue to become a good person, let the statue be there. Likewise, all this thing that you see hanging here and there and the squares and the reds and different things that are there is also the same thing. For me, if I am with my hair shaved and my uniform of the nun or the habit of the nun or whatever you call that, robes we call them, robes of a nun that I wear, if that helps me and inspires me and reminds me to be a good person, then that's the method that I apply. Eventually, it is not dependent upon a uniform, a dictum, a discipline, a method, or a different kind of a belief or a path. That is why if someone were to say, what is Buddhism? It would be a person who really realizes the importance of exercising one's own mind to understand the basic goodness, the basic truth of a human potential. That basic goodness is intrinsic. Everyone wants happiness. Nobody wants suffering. That itself is the biggest proof that intrinsic to a human nature is basic goodness, basic kindness. We identify and someone with even the minimum of awareness or knowledge, let's say a person who really has some kind of mental incapability, even such a person, when you rub something soft on his cheek or her cheek, that is enjoyed versus something that is rough and that is hard and there's a sense of, oh, this is not good. So the softness, the gentility, the simplicity, the purity, the goodness, that is easily something that we identify, that we can actually acknowledge. And that is the basic appreciation for basic goodness that is inside of our own selves. And so when that is a good quality that can help oneself and that can help the others, question is, why not develop it? Why should there be anyone with awareness or with human intelligence who could bring so much goodness in one's own life that would affect and benefit others' life, still continue to, for very vague reasons or very useless reasons, still continue to inflict harm and suffering and difficulties and negativities on one another? And so if we say, why do we get angry? Whereas everyone knows anger is not good. Why do we develop immense self-attachment, which does not allow us to be kind to the others? Why do we fall prey to jealousy or arrogance that is not comfortable to us, nor is comfortable to the others? Like children, everyone could be good. Everyone could be on the spot, whatever it is, honest with one's own feelings, and never really getting muddled and caught in the complexities of holding to greed, holding to selfishness, holding to resentment, holding to fear, holding to hope, that at the end doesn't seem to be very helpful anyway. But we spend years and years with our resentment. We spend years and years in fear. We spend years and years in our own desire and in our own attachment. And Saturdays, Sundays, Mondays, and Tuesdays, that could be a happy Saturday, Sunday, and a Monday, and a Tuesday, turns out to be a gloomy Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, where neither is one happy, nor another person is given any kind of happiness. And a whole human life wasted that way is an immense mark of immense stupidity and ignorance. What is not? And so, whether as a Buddhist we would believe in many lifetimes, as a person who doesn't believe in many lifetimes, also fine. But at least from the time we are born until the time we are dead, it could be a happy life, isn't it? It could be a life that is led with gentleness. I'm happy, you're happy, and everything is good. There's enough space for everyone. In any case, everyone is alive. There is general wish for happiness in everyone. There is no reason to look at a person you've never met in your life and still compete with that person. There's the ability to have genuine goodness and genuine well-being, harmony within one's own self, and appreciating that need of harmony and general well-being in the other person's life also. Sense of expansiveness of goodness that I want as well as the others want. But then, as anyone who's able to think a little bit, we find everything is the opposite. We've ended up making everything the opposite. And so while there is immense wish for happiness, none of us seem to be exerting a little extra effort in making sure that that is what is being done. And so we find this whole world that we have created, a whole world of suspicion, of hesitation, of just individuality, where even the very simplest of common kindness and loving kindness has become such a complicated issue. And sometimes, as when we sit in meditation, and sometimes, if I take myself as an example, sometimes when I sit and try to extend generosity or kindness or loving kindness to the others, one ends up in a very amusing state, some kind of laugh at one's own self and the immense sort of show or demonstration of what we are trying to do. Because one of the ways of looking at it is nothing could be a bigger joke on human civilization than religion teaching a person to be kind, if you look at it from one perspective. Someone who's endowed with the most common ability, at the most basic ability of generating loving kindness and compassion. As a meditator, sometimes I think takes 10, 15 years of living in a cave meditating before you begin to actually think that loving kindness and compassion is a good thing to generate. And so that we have to resort to a complicated philosophy and become a religious meditator who takes on arduous different methods of religion to figure out the simplicity. That's a big joke on human intelligence. That's a very big, I think, if there was a joke, biggest joke that was played on by God or by Buddha or whoever it is, it worked. And so in that way, then human ignorance, another way of looking at it is, that's the intensity of human ignorance. We don't choose to be ignorant. We don't choose to be unkind. We just succumb to giving immense reasons so that our own unawareness can maintain its speed, and the awareness, that is the intrinsic quality, continues to be weakened. And so Buddhism then talks about, well, that is not so simple as that either. First, we think about human intelligence and the potential we have. Then we think about the interdependency and the immense power of action that can bring happiness or suffering on the others. But Buddhism goes a little bit further to also discuss karma, a popular topic for any Buddhist practitioner. For some, it can be a little bit complicated or, I think, reason to be curious about. Karma is very easy. Karma is simply cause and effect. You do something, and there's a reaction. There's a effect of it. And to always connect karma with life and rebirth is also not necessary. Instant karma is also there. And so instant karma is any action that you do that can give happiness or that can give suffering to the others. And common logic or common examination easily allows a person to understand the power of karma. Is that although one's action may not seemingly be very powerful, but one of the aspects of it is that you are very powerful. You can make someone happy. You can make someone unhappy. You can give immense kindness to somebody, and yet you could also be somebody who's very selfish, who's very greedy, who's very unkind. That's the power of karma. Karma simply is a Sanskrit word or an Eastern word that means action. And so the power of the action that you have, that can be a cause of happiness, which is the fruit, or unhappiness, which is the fruit that you experience and therefore it is called karma ripening on yourself, or that that action can result in the experience, becoming an experience in the life of the others, and that is called karma ripening on the others. And so when we begin to understand interdependency, we also see that the interdependency and the ability to affect one another's life is through the power of karma. And so that karma is then understood as the Buddhist principle of not preparing for this life and another life, but of this moment, and understanding the immense karma or the immense action, power of the action that can bring about a fruition in your life and in the lives of the others. So when the basic concept of yourself as a human being with the potential to think, speak, and act is understood, that then leads the meditator to be aware of, again, as I said, the ability to actually taming it, training your body, your speech, and your mind, because it is interdependent with many others and you're not an island alone as an individual that doesn't affect others' lives. Then it further progresses into, if it affects other people's lives, then that is called karmic fruition, or the cause and effect that is there that we share with one another. That then forms what is called the reason why anyone would meditate. That comes always to a point where you are given a choice of not meditating and becoming a good person who is aware of one's karmic responsibilities, or somebody who would be a little bit more honest in saying, yes, I do have the potential of developing mindfulness without meditation, but am I actually being true? And so in being true to one's own potential, we see that although I appreciate compassion, I understand I can train my mind to be kind to the others, I can also see there is interdependency and therefore I need to be careful of my social responsibilities. But then on the other hand, also recognizing that unawareness is something I'm so accustomed to doing. I'm so used to saying things that I don't even think about. I'm so used to doing things the way I used to, that I am always doing, that I don't even have to think about it. So if someone is unkind, it's so easy to just say something cutting back rather than to come to a point of saying, oh yes, there's karma and there's discriminating wisdom and I'm better than a frog and I need to be a skillful rider. So if a person is more equipped with that spontaneous awareness of who you are and your potentials, then you don't have to meditate. But practically speaking, that's not how it happens. We're most of the time on that horse that is in every direction. And so if any person, a kind person, were to give a sort of a method that would enable us, the best method seems to begin with sit quietly and think carefully. And so that term has been used as meditation. So people make a big deal out of meditation, but it's quite similar to when we used to go to kindergarten school and be very rowdy. Teachers would tell us to sleep on our desks by what would be called is put your head on your arms. And what is that? Yes, put your heads down. Very good. You're there at the moment. So put your heads down and just lie down there for a quiet time. Or these days I think they do is to lie down completely and just rest for a little while. It's the same thing. It's about the speediness of our accustomed or the speediness with which we are used to functioning without thinking, saying things, without thinking of things, without thinking, doing the things. That when it comes to developing the values and the genuine basic goodness of human nature, we have to come back to the very basic fundamentals of why don't you just sit down and think a little bit. And so meditation, what is called shamatha meditation, contemplative meditation, calm-abiding meditation, single-pointed meditation, spiritual meditation, Buddhist meditation, all kinds of terms that are used, that's again like the bunch of the carrot that says something will happen. Just sit first quietly. And it helps. It helps. It's very simple. But on the other hand, not that what we are used to very much doing. And so we then, our ego takes a very big, I think, some kind of a, let's say, beating in meditation when we first begin to meditate. And there is fidgetiness, and there is complaint, and there's a lot of resistance, there's a lot of frustration. That, if we really examine carefully, makes us understand how very little control is there to our own body, to our own mind, to our own speech. And so the ego takes another beating in then being able to say, well, talking about lofty things such as being kind to everyone and being generous to everyone is one thing. But if we are to actually come down to the basics of human honesty, we find that there's still a lot more to do. And we see an entire lifetime that we've lived, and up till now, how many are the different actions that we have done that are actually proof of having lived a life of basic awareness, of goodness, of being a good human being. It is not that I did not know that it was important that I be a good person. I knew that. I teach others. But on the other hand, 40 years of my life, if I look back and see how much of that I have practiced, then within that flash of a moment of what has been 40 years, I've hardly given that any real thought. And so one understands that's how easily my mind wanders. That's how easily I let life pass by without having developed what was an inner quality of basic goodness that every individual human being is endowed with. That's suffering. That's painfulness. That's a painfulness that we all experience, sadness that we all experience of what could have been and what did not happen. And so that then can be used in two ways. One is you break down in tears and you cry at what has been 40 years of time wasted. Or on the other hand, you can probably strengthen or go in a much more positive direction by saying, let's see if I can do better in the next 40 years if I have a chance. Not that that is sure that I have another 40 years, but still being optimistic, let's see if tomorrow there can be some beginning where I can listen a little bit more than speak. Think a little bit more before doing something. And physically, if I am to do something, let's make it a little bit better, that others may have happiness, that others may enjoy life, that others may be a little bit able to have peacefulness in their life because I'm alive today. And so if 15 minutes of my sitting can do that, then that's good. If not only sitting and if I get too fidgety in that, then someone will be kind enough to say, okay, visualize something very remarkable, like some being that you can't really blame very much because it doesn't look like anyone you know, with, let's say, whose body is painted dark blue with a fierce-looking face, but also radiating a lot of warmth. Just picture someone and allow your mind to focus on that and see if you can actually be so entranced by what you're visualizing that you actually forget about resentment and anxiousness and hope and fear. And so Buddhism came up with all kinds of techniques that we call visualized meditation. And so you see, if you look at this banner, for example, it has things that you probably haven't seen around here in Luray very much. Let's say a conch shell here. That's on a lotus and that has a lot of banners over there, and one is a flag and one is a vase, what is called the victory banner and parasol and so on and so forth. Or if you look at there, or you see this round figure here, this hung. On the shrine you'll find quite Tibetan-looking, Indian-looking figures that we look at and stare at for a long period of time as our daily meditation. Those of you who are familiar are familiar. Those who are not familiar, then they are methods. We call them politely methods. Or impolitely, I call them bunches of carrots that makes a stubborn donkey move. But that's how it is. As a human mind, we always think something else is needed to make us realize that we can be better as human beings. And so some people go into caves to realize that. Some people sit on meditation cushions to realize that. Some people have philosophy, analysis, logic, scientific examination. And these days they're doing that too. These days the most popular thing to do is catch monks and nuns and put all kinds of wires on them, and they tell us to meditate and see if some spark can glow or bulbs can light up because of you are in single meditation. And we are doing that also. Anything that might help a person to begin to realize kindness is important. So if a whole group of intelligent scientists one day, because a bulb lights up because of a wire in the head of a monk or a nun, begins to realize that besides all the breaking up of molecules and cells, that there is such a thing as basic goodness, intrinsic, that we need to be good human beings, then that's good. No matter how many examinations it takes, it is very good. not only the lighting up of the bulbs, but what we have been doing is what I think is the square cushion, which is where the starting ground is. And so, as anyone who may need a bunch of carrots that look like a spiritual field, spiritual doctrine or a philosophy, then Buddhism is a spiritual philosophy and a doctrine. It has more to do with devotion and creation and being there and discipline and ethics than any other philosophy in the world. If, again, a person may become a better person by saying this is not needed, Buddhism also is completely open to the idea of nothing is needed if a person were to realize genuine goodness. So one path, one dictum, one discipline is not there in Buddhism. Buddhism is about being able to point out the basic goodness, the basic truth inherent, and then it leaves up to the person to choose the path according to whatever you think will make you a better person. So long as some things are followed, and one is stillness of the body, second is stillness of the speech, and the third is stillness of the mind. Sitting quietly, sitting reflectively inward, because you need to become accustomed to thinking carefully of what it is that as a human being you need to develop, rather than allowing the mind to always run away speedily. Because if you allow the mind to run away speedily, then often what happens is you begin to fall back into the same pattern. Now, if I take myself as an example, up till now, I've allowed that to happen, speediness of body, speech, and mind. And what have I gotten today until today? And every day, as part of our meditation, I think about it before going to sleep, half an hour sitting and seeing, up till now, if this is the last moment of my life, up till now, what have I done that I can be really happy about? And every day, the answer is the same, nothing. Other than talking a lot, nothing. On a good day, you think something's come out of all that talking. But on a bad day, even that is lost. And so that truthfully speaking, one can always pacify oneself or console oneself by saying, oh yes, something has been done. I've given birth to my children, or I've married someone, or I've created a family, or I'm true to my job, or many people are employed because of me. Whatever it is, we can come up with that. But if we look a little bit more carefully, most of us will end up with really not having done anything. And it's a big waste of this life. And so that begins to be the inspiration tomorrow morning to become someone who maybe at the end of the day can sit down and think, yes, I did something today. I made someone happy. I made someone able to have a little bit of a better day and an easier day because my body was able to help, because my speech was able to help, or I thought in a certain way that allowed me to be patient, that gave happiness to the other. And so that is meditation. And so for that, if you are spiritual and it helps you to become such a person, then Buddhism is a spiritual philosophy. If regarding meditation as helpful, then one can take meditation, and that is also very helpful. If by studies and by analysis it allows you to think in that way, then study and analysis of Buddhist philosophy is also there. It is also possible. People who find land and need 200 acres before they can begin to realize the importance of being a good person, then buy this expensive piece of property and then struggle to pay mortgage for the rest of our lives and still discover that, yes, we can be good and kind to one another. But one way of looking at it is, if today, this evening, all of us can have half an hour of happiness, genuine, honest happiness, then this land coming together has, I think, fulfilled its purpose. That was the intent with which this land was bought, why everyone is practicing here. And so that is how we would like it to be. And so a lotus garden, a joyous lotus garden would be, lotus grows in a muddy pond, it is said, but none of the muddiness sticks to the lotus. And the lotus in full bloom is a happy lotus. And so in the midst of all the chaos and confusion, if a group of people can practice genuine kindness, not only in view and philosophy, but in genuine life, and can bring about radiance of happiness around, then that is the blessings of the Buddhist philosophy, or the blessings of our meditation, the fruition of our aspiration, and that would be, I think, accomplishing the purpose with which everyone is practicing Dharma here, the Buddhist teachings here. And so where it goes, it will be something to watch out for. I'd like to see where we go with this. I'm sure many of you would like to see where we go with this, but there's no harm in having good hope. It is a potential that we all have, and some of us will do it by sitting in meditation, some of us will do it mowing the lawns, some of us will do it by resisting meditation, and some of us will do it by loving meditation. But whichever way it is, as long as we all end up being a good human being, Buddhism is always, I think, succeeded and has been fruitioned. That's the way I see it. So, my warning to you, those who haven't officially entered the path of Buddhism, is keep it simple. Don't let people make it complicated. Now, if you choose to make it complicated because you like complexity, then that's your choice. Then we'll only say, welcome to the club. But a warning in the beginning is, it's very simple. Dharma, Buddhism is very simple. I grew up, as some of you probably know, I went to a Western school and I studied at the monastery in a very traditional way. And I grew up studying in a Catholic convent for most of my earlier life, 11 or 13 years. And 2 years I went to a very strict Unitarian church, Protestant school. And however, half the day I would always come back to where I was born, in a monastery, a Buddhist monastery, and I studied there. And scriptural studies, Bible studies, was always very nice. Although it is, I think, also how you teach younger children, and the people who taught us Bible studies were very, very kind people, and probably they did not give us the full theological approach to it. But in comparison to the Buddhist studies that I went through at home, I always thought Bible studies was much more enjoyable and very directly, formally put. Buddhist meditation doesn't have that kind of form. Partly is why what I've been saying is, but is not, it's up to you, but you can choose, but it's not the right choice, you have to do it. So it really doesn't seem to make up its mind what you want it to be done, what you want it to be actually happening. Whereas the way the Bible studies was, you should do this and you shouldn't do that, it was very clear cut. And I thought, why couldn't the Buddhists learn that? If you want to say something, say it out straight. It is far more simple than to say a lot of things and then not really get anywhere with it and leave it up. There's a lot of different ways to approach at it. But I always thought Buddhism had the tendency of making things more complicated than it was necessary to do so, particularly when it came to theology and philosophy and so forth, the higher views as we study, because it always said, it is there, it is there, it is there, it is there, ultimately it is not there. Or it is not there, it is not there, it is not there, but ultimately it is like this. So it never really was very clear. And there were these years between the ages of 14 as I became a teenager up to about 19 or 20 years old, there was that period in my life where I think was one of the frustrating times, because I always compared it with the other religious studies and found Buddhism to unnecessarily complicate things very much. Now, today when I look back and I think about it, I find, particularly when I teach more nowadays, I find there's no way you can say a simple thing in a simple way and people appreciate that. So the trick is to complicate it. Make it so complex and build it up to such a complex level that they have no other way but to run back to the simplicity on their own accord. Because the simplicity simply doesn't get appreciated enough. And so that's our human behavior. It's the complex answers. I remember very oftentimes with a little bit of understanding of Dharma, some thinking and analysis that we used to carry, I used to run back to my teachers to ask what I thought were profound questions. And the answer that was always given to me was, be kind. And that was not the answer I was looking for. I was looking for the absolute truth of phenomena, the absolute true nature of mind. What was human essence? And what was the essence actually like? Was it form? Was it formless? How are we actually going to understand what is the enlightened mind? And our teachers always said, be kind. My teacher happened to also be my father, so it got even more frustrating because neither as a father nor as a teacher he could say anything but other than be kind. And I thought, they just don't like me. And then you grow up with the concept of being a woman and in a man's situation with all the monks and the teachers and the students all being men. So maybe they don't want to tell me what it is. And they think it's a much more gentle, womanly approach to just say, be kind. I remember getting very frustrated. I remember throwing texts. I remember banging doors open and shutting them and breaking glasses because of the frustration of not getting a very complex answer. And today I seem to be doing the same thing. So, and so the more one thinks about what Buddhism is, what meditation is, what any spiritual philosophy is, simplicity of the kindness is that which is simple to say and is the very ultimate answer, but it's always the most difficult thing to practice. It's so close, and yet we make it so complicated, so very distant of us. It's something that is universally known and easy to understand and acknowledge because it is our intrinsic nature, and yet we have to resort to the complexities of philosophy. And that is, I think, one aspect of immense suffering that we all experience, is so simple and yet so difficult to practice. So we take to the cushion and hope that that will give us a little bit of a push in becoming a better person. So, I think that's it for tonight. Okay? After that, Andre will continue.
Thank you, Rinpoche. Would you permit a question or two? Or?
If there are, yes.
Andre knows that I always have questions.
Okay. All right. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Good.
For me, the most difficult stumbling block that I've read about is reading about the three lower realms and the necessity for meditating on what is unthinkable and extreme suffering over unthinkably long periods. I hope and I find it difficult to believe that that kind of suffering even exists, and I certainly don't see how I could deal with meditating on it, even for 5 minutes.
Hmm.
Do you believe that these sufferings exist, and do you believe that there's some substantive thing to be gained by meditating on it?
Hmm. Buddhism does talk about the different kinds of realms of existences. It's very amusing for us Easterners to meet sometimes with our old-time Buddhist practitioners who still have difficulty in the concept of, let's say, the other realms of existences. Because many of the people who are practicing Buddhism today have a Christian background and have had questions in their life about the hell and the heaven concept. And then they came and studied Buddhism, and then they find in Buddhism not only one hell, but 18 different kinds of hell realms and other very, I think, dramatic experiences, such as the Preta realm and the animal realm, the three lower realms that you are referring to. Are they existent or not existent? If you ask me, they are existent. They do exist. Where do they exist is not as concrete as some Buddhists will believe. If you ask my grandmother, for example, who's a very orthodox, devout Buddhist, has not much interest in philosophy and truth, but is very, very devoted to her, particularly her son-in-law, then she will be of that kind who will think that the hell realm exists about 500 leagues under the ground. She'll be that concrete, her belief. And to tell her otherwise would be almost a very difficult thing, let's say. But that is not the way I would look at it. Because when we study Dharma, when we study the Buddhist teachings, what we begin to understand is the immense power of our imagination. If you say, for example, someone who is a very good friend of mine, someone I trust very much, despite my immense trust in that person, does something that is very hurtful to me. after that moment of experience of very strong, distrust or very strong pain that that person has given, even if that person is not thinking about me, but is talking to a group of people, my mind's imagination will begin to tell me they are talking about me, they're planning another way of attacking me, he's explaining his stand and making me the black sheep. Yeah, that one is now going to come and then defamation is going to happen. I begin to have an imagination, and from that imagination and my suspicion and my own mental processing and thought about that, create a realm of existence in my own self, which is full of pain, which is full of suffering. So when we talk about human realms or other realms, we are talking about the immense potential of mind's ability to create a realm around one's own self. And we create a realm of happiness if we are projecting happiness. And we create a realm of extreme suffering if it is caused out of resentment and anger and suspicion and negativeness. And so that needs to be understood as how powerful mind is in creation of a realm of existence of its own. And so therefore, me and my perspective of the world today is this. All of you and myself and Lotus Garden and Luray and Virginia and so on and so forth. It's my way of responding, my mind's ability to respond to the perception that I have. Likewise, at this moment, let's say, if I'm inflicted with immense suffering, it will be the same projection, but the quality of that projection and the perception will be very different. It'll be very low, it'll be very dark, it'll be very full of suffering, it'll be full of pain, a lot of negativeness also. So that's the power of mind's projection of a realm of existence, and we create that. It is within that context that Buddhism talks about sufferings of the lower realms. It's just the immense causes that we create to bring about ourselves enveloped in an environment that in some cases may be of immense suffering. And so human terminology doesn't leave us much with any other word other than, in English, hell realm. Whereas the actual word nyewa, that is taken as that which is translated as hell, is not hell per se if you compare it with the English usage of the term. Nyewa simply means immense suffering. And so how much suffering is up to the degree of the imagination and projection of your own mind. And causes being there. So if you've brought about a cause of immense anger or aggression or suffering, pain and hurtfulness in one's own self, one does have the capacity of creating that suffering realm around one's own self. And if it is clear for a person to understand it by the usage of the term hell, then we do have the capacity of creating a hell realm around our own selves. That is how we then perceive it. And so, as we simply say, if I can create this, then I can create the other. If I can create a good, nice day because of my causes of any good causes that we've created around ourselves, likewise, I can create causes that are full of unhappiness. And what would we call that other than the hell realm experience? That's how we explain it. Second part of suffering is then the truth of suffering is also there. And I've always thought, the suffering as explained within the Buddhist philosophy and the texts of immense diverse kinds of suffering is actually a very small part of the immense suffering that is there. The greatest suffering is the beauty and the goodness and the niceties and the color and the various usages of the adjectives that we have that covers up what is, I think, the genuine ignorance of the mind. Inability to really train oneself, inability to love, inability to let go of anger and aggression, inability to let go of useless arrogance and jealousy, competitiveness that breeds so much sadness in oneself and in the others. And if one looks at that ignorance that completely covers such basic understanding, that I think is far more intense in terms of suffering, it being a suffering, than the bleeding and the cutting and the different forms of suffering, as is mentioned in the text, which is there, and one needs to broaden one's understanding of how we do have such suffering around ourselves. And yet, it's something that's very apparent. The hidden suffering that is there, that is covered with beautiful things, that's even a greater suffering. So if we look at it from that perspective, it's not so difficult to understand. The long periods of wandering or looking into suffering, it need not be long periods of meditating on suffering. It could be a fraction if it is inspiring enough to not fall back on negativities. If your contemplation on a particular suffering is even very short period of time, for a very short period of time, but is inspiring enough that you never forget it, and allow that reminder to constantly be the inspiration of generosity and kindness, then it need not be for a long period of time. It took Buddha himself to just look at one example of birth, old age, sickness, and death to begin to search for, there must be something beyond just living a life. But we see birth, old age, sickness, and death every day of our lives, never come up with the question, there has to be something more to life than just living a life. And so, again, one example that comes to mind always is if you're coming out of a baseball game or a very big game, and usually when you come out and you want to go to your car, but the force of the crowd is such that you end up in a different gate, in a different direction. Sometimes it happens. Likewise, life is like that too. We want to go in a particular direction, but how many of us actually can come out of that push and pull of habitual ways of thinking and set patterns of living a life that we never come up with a thing, possibly I could do more in terms of being a better person. Possibly I could think a little bit more. Possibly I could actually do something constructive in giving happiness to another person. We never come up on our own accord. It always has to be some teacher, some great master who points the way. On our own self, we don't seem to come up with a question. And that's the difference between a Buddha and a common person, ourselves, is that it took him to look at birth, old age, sickness, and death, and to be inspired enough to come up with, who am I as a human being and what are my potentials? And we don't seem to do that. And that's why someone says, spend, let's say, the next 2 or 3 years reflecting upon suffering. It's not that the suffering is not there. It's just so well hidden, and we allow it to be well hidden, that the mind doesn't shake itself enough to come out of the slumber of its ignorance. So if it can happen in a short period of time, that's a very lucky person. Such a person does not need to contemplate on all the cuttings and the sort of the different kinds of descriptions of what sufferings are. It doesn't have to be for a very long period of time. But then you take myself for an example. Every day I meditate on the worst possible examples of suffering. Yet it is never afraid to create an unvirtuous action of unkindness. That is how rigid and stubborn my mind is. And so what do I do with such a rigid and a stubborn mind is wait for another teacher to come up with even a much more drastic example of what suffering is before it can shake itself to understanding. Yes, that's the extreme, or that's the extent that human ignorance can take us to. And so that's the purpose with which there are some methods of contemplation that does emphasize reflection on suffering a great deal. Whether or not it is needed or not is entirely dependent upon what will it take for you to develop wakefulness of one's own potentials. And so, as I said, Buddhism is never going to say you need to do it for that period of time. It's up to you. And some people say, why do we have to reflect upon the ugliness of suffering to become a good person? Why can't we look at the beauty of nature or the beauty of the flower to be able to be a good person? And I've always said, yes, if looking at the beauty of the flower makes you a better person, by all means, no one will stop you from doing that. But on the other hand, if suffering can't make you a better person, looking at no suffering will make you a better person, able to give up your own selfishness, it will be very difficult. Practically speaking, that will be very difficult. We are asking people to be kind. And if people can be kind by reflecting on the unkindness and the suffering that people go through if you're not kind, and that is, again, not going to happen, but by looking at people having everything and therefore you have to be kind, will be very difficult in comparison. So it's a method that is applied in Buddhism. As I said, it's not a discipline that has to be followed in that particular way. You choose the path that you feel most comfortable with, as long as the goal is achieved.
Thank you.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. Good night, everyone.